The following is a paid commercial program. Unless otherwise identified, the guests on the program are employees of or otherwise represent the advertiser. The opinions expressed therein are those of the advertiser and do not necessarily reflect the views and policies of 900CHML.
We are planning your financial future. I'm Scott Thompson. Don Fox and Mitch Fox are here from Fox Group Private Wealth Management. You can find out more at donfox.net. You can call them at IG Private Wealth Management at 905-972-7420. Good morning, gentlemen. Good to see your faces on this post-budget show.
Yes. Good morning, Scott. And we'll get to that budget a little later.
Yeah, all right, good morning, guys.
So I guess the good news over and above all of that, whatever way you want to look at it, the inflation rate is 2.9%. What does that mean?
Yeah, that's a good point, Scott. And you know, it's kind of interesting. We're actually going the opposite way of the U.S. And you're seeing theirs is actually went up, ticked up to 3.5%. We went down to 2.9%, and that's the overall inflation rate. And that would include mortgage, rent prices, gasoline prices, and food. Those are the ones that are somewhat volatile. And if you take those out, we're right down to that around 2%, 1.9% now. And so this is right where the government's saying, okay, we'll lower interest rates when we get down to that 2% level. Well, it's definitely there. And we should be starting to see some lower interest rates. We are in a totally different place than the U.S. And, you know, their economy is booming. Our unemployment rate is around just over 6% right now. They're not dealing with the same issues we're dealing with. And so you've noticed our Canadian dollar has gone down because we're basically, the experts are expecting the interest rates to go down. And if the U.S. doesn't drop theirs, our dollar would go down with it. So it'll get a little more expensive to travel, but better for the economy. It's overdue. We're actually, you know, you could actually say we are very close to a recession. We're just borderline, just slight growth, where the U.S. is actually doing okay. So yeah, good news from those people with needing interest rates to go down.
Let me ask you a question. Are we closer to a recession or an election?
Oh God, I wish it was the second of the two, Scott, because a lot of the policies, of course, are reason why our economy is also doing a little worse than the U.S. at this stage.
Yeah, and Mitch, the holes just keep getting a little deeper and deeper, and they keep coming out with these policies that are inadvertently also kind of hurting some of the causes out there. Right.
Well, and again, the budget just was last week. We'll dive a lot deeper next week. But again, it's kind of just saying what we've always done. The rich need to pay more. And they've already, if the rich weren't already paying more before the budget, they certainly know it now. When you're at a 53.53% tax bracket for anybody that makes over $246,000 this year, you know, you tell this to anybody living in the U.S. and they say, are you kidding me? We are paying extreme amounts of income tax here in Canada, more than what we're making in some cases for those people. And of course, a lot of people say, that doesn't apply to me. I don't make that much money, so I'm okay. Well, what about if you pass away and all your RSPs are taxed in the year of death, or you have to sell your cottage because you died? Estate taxes, basically, the government's going to be getting more than 50% unless you do a lot of planning. And this, the good news for us is that's exactly what we do, is planning. And that helps us. We've been able to help clients save thousands of dollars. I know I'll be discussing some ways to save some income tax a little later. But I know, Mitch, you want to discuss our DSPs.
Yeah. Well, first, I just wondered, the budget hasn't balanced itself yet, has it? Did I miss something?
No,
it's still not balanced. Okay. Well, it's been a few years.
Yes. And that is exactly why, now have gray hair and not much of it. Now the budget has been balanced. There you go.
32 and I got the salt and pepper. Nice.
It's
been stressful. But yeah, I just wanted to start by going over the Registered Disability Savings Plan here. And it's a very important topic because it's often overlooked by many financial planners, and many families just don't know about it. The awareness is not out there the same as our registered retirement savings plans, TFSAs, and other accounts, trust funds, corporations. You really don't hear much about the RDSP, as well as collecting ODSP, getting a monthly payment. And just to put things into context here, here are some statistics from a Canadian survey. So over 22% of Canadians aged 15 and over have a disability. That's roughly 6 million people. Only 59% of those aged 25 to 64 have jobs, compared to 80% of people without disabilities. So there is quite the gap there of about 20% between that age gap of people who have jobs and who don't in that age range. But the really eye-opening stat is the one that only 28% of those who qualify for an RDSP, a Registered Disability Savings Plan, have actually opened one. When someone in your family has a disability, there are many unique financial challenges that must be faced. You may worry about the future and how they're going to prepare for it. So some common questions that we get during meetings are, where do I begin to save for their future? Will anything I do impact their social assistance benefits, such as their ODSP? Are there tax benefits or government programs available? If something happens to me, how can I make sure that they're going to be taken care of? And as you know, every person with a disability is different. There's many different qualifying disabilities and many different caregiving and financial needs to consider. So every family is different. And one program available is the Disability Tax Credit. The Disability Tax Credit is a non-refundable tax credit that helps people with disabilities or their supporting people reduce the amount of income tax they may have to pay. So there are many factors to consider about how much each person gets, but with this, the maximum amount that you can get is roughly about $8,800 for this. And if a child under 18 qualifies for a disability tax credit, you may be eligible for the child disability benefit as well, which is a supplement to the Canada Child Benefit and Children's Special Allowances payments. It helps low and modest income families who care for a children under 18 with a severe prolonged mental or physical impairment. And this can get you another additional $5,200, as well as that $88 that you can get there. So who is eligible for the disability tax credit? Someone who has physically or mental impairment that is severe and prolonged in vision, speaking, hearing, walking, feeding, dressing, and mental functions necessary just to live a daily life. The next program I want to talk to you about is the Registered Disability Savings Plan. It's a long-term savings plan for anyone that has a disability and that qualifies for the disability tax credit. So a resident of Canada, and you also have to have a social insurance number and be under the age of 60 to open one. So parents or guardians, you can open one for a minor, and there's no annual contribution limit, but there's a lifetime limit of $200,000. So you can deposit $200,000 in one go, or you can do it over a select bunch of years. It really depends on the situation of the family. So RDSP can be set up with a beneficiary who's eligible for the disability tax credit, and you are going to get matching as well. So it depends on your family income. If a family income is $98,000 or less, a contribution of $1,500 is going to result in about $3,500 for the year. If a family income is more than $98,000, a contribution of $1,000 will get you $1,000. And that's the maximum that you're going to get. The maximum amount of grant that you can get throughout the lifetime of the RDSP is $70,000, which that's a lot of money to get from the government, matching one-to-one or even better. So this is a great program to use.
And Mitch, on top of that, you know, you look at that, and that's just the amount they give you, never mind the growth in that money and how it can be invested. It really does take off. We've got a number of clients that have those accounts, and some of the disabilities are very, you know, significant, and others aren't as significant. So it's always best to apply to see if you qualify.
Yeah. And that's why it's 28% of people who are eligible for this are using the program. It's just, it's eye-opening. Like you said, it might be a minor disability, but you're still going to qualify for it. And you can take advantage of the grant that you're going to get, as well as the compound growth on that grant. I mean, the earlier that you start, the better, obviously. We've talked about compound interest countless amount of times on this show. And obviously, the earlier you start, the more that your money's going to work for you, and it's going to grow a lot more substantially for when you have to use it. So a common question that we get with the RDSP is, what if my income's so high, my child will be lower, should I delay the RDSP until they turn 19? And the answer is no. The grant entitlements are fixed in a year and won't change because you wait to pick them up in a year, as well as the benefit of opening it while they're young, like we just said about the compound interest. Getting the interest working for you as soon as possible is always going to be beneficial there. The other one here that I want to talk about is the Ontario Disability Savings Plan. And this is an Ontario-specific plan. This is eligible for Ontarians that are over the age of 18 to support people with disabilities. The program is administered by the Ministry of Children. This is meant to cover two areas, shelter and basic living needs. And the maximum amount you can get from this program is $497 for shelter and $672 for living needs. And this is not going to be affected by your RDSP income. So if you do have an RDSP and you are drawing an income from it, you're still going to be able to collect this ODSP. So you can have an RDSP as well as collecting this. You must be over 18, as I mentioned, and qualify as a disabled person. And we kind of went through that definition as well. Another point that I want to mention here is that if your parents or if they saved up money for you, is that going to affect your ODSP? The short answer is that it can. And people with ODSP, you can have $40,000 in assets, such as a bank account, TFSA, non-registered. And you can have up to $100,000 in different asset class, such as cash surrender value from a life insurance policy or inherited funds in a trust or seg funds, which is also kind of a life insurance investment product. So one strategy that can be implemented to qualify for the ODSP, if you do have, let's say, $150,000, you could put $30,000 into a TFSA if you qualify, if you have enough room, into a mutual fund, stock, ETF portfolio. You could put $80,000 into, if you have more TFSA room or a non-registered, and you could have that in seg funds. And then the last part of it, you can put into an RDSP, which is also going to be sheltered from the ODSP qualifications. So by doing this, you're going to allow room for growth, because if you do grow over those thresholds, you are going to forfeit the ODSP income that you're going to get. So if you are under all of that, you're still going to qualify and get that income. But if you do grow over that, you're going to have to either move it into your RDSP if you have space, or you're just going to completely forfeit that bit of income. So make sure you're talking to a financial planner that knows about these programs, because as I mentioned, it's very underutilized and your financial planner should know about it.
We are planning your financial future. I'm Scott Thompson. Don Fox and Mitch Fox are here from Fox Group Private Wealth Management. You can find out more at donfox.net. You can call them at IG Private Wealth Management at 905-972-7420. We're going to take a break here. We're coming right back.
You are listening to a paid commercial program. Unless otherwise identified, the guests on the program are employees of or otherwise represent the advertiser. The opinions expressed therein are those of the advertiser and do not necessarily reflect the views and policies of 900CHML.
We are planning your financial future. I'm Scott Thompson. Don Fox and Mitch Fox are here from Fox Group Private Wealth Management. You can find out more at donfox.net. You can call them at IG Private Wealth Management at 905-972-7420. We're talking about capital gain reserves. What is this all about?
You know what? It's that time of year. We're still in tax seasons, kind of, and a lot of people are unaware there's such a thing as a capital gain reserve. And to the point that I've actually had accountants question the availability for this for certain clients of mine. This actually just happened last week. So I thought, well, if accountants are sometimes don't know about them, or somewhat, you know, there's so many rules in the Tax Act, so I can't really blame any particular. But you know what? In this particular case, we actually worked out an exact plan on how to do this. And then the accountant in this case said, oh, no, that only qualifies for farms. Well, capital gain reserves do not just qualify for farms, although they can get a longer reserve, and this is where maybe the confusion was, they can get a 10-year reserve, where the maximum for other types of properties is a 5-year reserve. So let me just back up a little bit. First of all, capital gains. What is a capital gain? Well, you buy a property, say for $100,000, you sell the property for $200,000, and you have now a $100,000 capital gain. And if it's a stock or something where you get immediate payback, well, there's no reserve. You can't. So you bought a stock for $100,000 and you sold it for $200,000 or a mutual fund or any investment where you get the money back right away, you don't qualify. But if there's a period of time that they're paying you back, that's a different story. So eligible, in a perfect example, so if somebody, say a property, an apartment building, a piece of land, et cetera, and they paid you back over 10 years. Well, you can only claim a reserve over 5 years. 5 years is the max, except for a few exceptions, but that's just assume most of the times most people don't fall into those exceptions. So are you eligible? Okay, yeah, of course. Like, we're dealing with the Canadian government, so they got some rules. And anytime the CRA is involved, first of all, and this is a good one, I think I totally agree, you must be a resident of Canada. So this, by the way, is very similar to a lot of the tax rules in Canada, tax-free savings accounts. You have to be a resident of Canada when you do it. An RESP, Registered Education Savings Plan, you have to be a resident when you make those contributions and you lose that room. Same with this capital gains reserve, you must be a resident of Canada. You also must not be exempt from paying tax. So some call it Native Canadians, they are exempt from paying income tax and therefore they would not qualify for this because they don't pay tax anyway. Additionally, if you sold the capital property to a corporation that you control, you can't control, it's almost double dipping in that way. And so therefore you cannot qualify for this capital gains reserve. That makes sense. I'm sure that was when somebody actually said, hey, I'm just going to sell it to myself and I'll pay myself over 5 years to delay this capital gain. No, you can't do that. So as I mentioned, this can only be claimed over 5 years. Unless it's a farm qualifies, a family fishing property, or some qualified small business shares. And if you've given the capital gain from a qualified capital asset to your child, and that's with the other part, and then to qualify, this must be a family farm, a family fishing. So if you pass down a farm to a son or daughter, then you can, put off this capital gains and spread it over 10 years. So great idea. So let's assume, here's an example that you have an apartment building and you sold it for $1.5 million. Now it only cost you $500,000. And you and your spouse, and let's assume in this case it's you and your wife are both 65 and both receiving the old age security. So the capital gain on this, you bought it for $500,000, you sold it for $1.5 million, is $1 million capital gain. Now, nice thing is it's owned by the two of you, and therefore the capital gain is $500,000 each. Now, the taxable capital gain is half that. With capital gains, you only pay tax on half of the capital gain. So therefore, in this case, each spouse would pay $250,000, it would be added to their incomes. $250,000 would be added to their incomes. Now, in this example, I'm going to assume each spouse has been pretty careful. They're getting their old age security. They have a little bit of investment income. They're making $40,000 a year, and they want to live life a little bit better. Hence why they sold this apartment building. They want to, and also there's a lot of work involved in owning properties. So they're in the lowest tax bracket. They're only making $40,000 a year each. Good deal. It's great for income splitting. So what they've worked out is the buyer is going to pay them back $300,000 for 5 years. So there's the $1.5 million. And they're going to spread that again over 5 years. And this is perfect, okay, because now you can spread this capital gain equally over 5 years. However, you got to know about the rule. And a lot of people are just saying, okay, I didn't know about this. I wish I knew about that, and hence why I'm talking about it now. So this would add, if you just didn't do anything about this and you added the capital gain equally to the two of you, so there's $250,000 to each spouse. So that brings their total income to $290,000 each. And I said earlier in the show, that it's criminal that we're at 53.53% tax brackets for incomes over $246,000. Well, here's an example of somebody selling a lifelong asset. They've had it forever, and they're rich for 1 year, the year they sold it. They're not rich all the time. They're saying, oh, this doesn't affect the middle class. These are middle class. They make $40,000 a year. They're rich for 1 year. This is no different than somebody who sells their family cottage, anything else. So again, this is where I think the net has gotten very big for what they consider rich. But anyway, I digress a little bit here. Okay. So let's just go here. And so in this case, though, they're 65. They're getting their old age security. They sell this apartment. They're now making 290 that year. They totally lose their old age security, both of them, for that year. Well, that's a fair bit. That's $8,600 each. Now, after tax, they got to pay tax on their old age security, but they're in the lowest tax bracket, around 20%. So the real cost is they're losing $6,850 each in old age security after tax. So they're missing $13,700. Now, the total tax cost of having this selling the apartment in their pocket, this is actually what it's going to cost them, is $216,000 of income tax. Now, not terrible. They did got $1.5 million, but it's not being paid all at once. And on top of that, they've lost their old age security. And on an after-tax basis, the overall cost is $230,000 by claiming this capital gain all in 1 year. So quite a bite, if you could say so myself. And now, at the other end, you listeners have heard that, now listening to this show, you're saying, you know what? I heard Mitch and Don talk about this capital gains reserve. You know, I'm going to talk to my accountant a bit. I'm going to look into this a bit more. So how this works is now you can claim 20% of your capital gain, each of you, over the next 5 years. So this would now be, the capital gain would be $200,000 each. Now the taxable capital gain is, I'm sorry, the 200, so the capital gain would be $200,000, which is $100,000 each. The taxable capital gain is now down to $50,000. So each spouse now has to have added to their income $50,000 of taxable capital gains. This would bring their income up to $90,000 each per year. Now, this is no coincidence. You lose your old age security at $91,000. Okay, so I did play with the numbers a little bit here. So this is a perfect scenario. But they're, at least they both collect their old age security. Now, this extra tax, it's going to cost them about $14,500 each per year more because of this. And they'll at least they get to, as I mentioned, collect their old age security. The total amount of tax paid over the whole 5 years, okay, including the fact they're getting their old age security, okay, is $145,000. So by knowing this capital gain reserve, this couple will save $85,000 of income tax. That is not chump change. So this, it's so important to know what your options are. And the, you know, tax is very complicated. This is where having a financial planner, not just an investment planner, that's simply going over what performance can we do with this, here's a way to invest. We do that too. But having somebody on your team that is looking at the big pictures to say, okay, how can we minimize tax? Because that is one thing we can guarantee. And I've changed all these numbers, but in the case that I dealt with this client last week, they would have lost their old age security and it would have bumped into a very high tax bracket for 1 year. And so by spreading it over, same as this example, they are going to spread it over 3 years. They are going to collect their OAS for all 3 years. And also it's going to be taxed at the lower tax bracket all those years. So nothing, there's two parts of this by, you know, using the capital gains reserve. One is avoiding the high tax bracket. Because like I talked, as I mentioned earlier, you don't like to be in that 50% tax bracket or 53% bracket. That's number one. And number two is nobody really likes to lose their old age security if they don't have to. So by using this reserve, you got to pay your share. I would argue your fair share, okay? But you don't have to pay more than that. So that's one tip that I think is overlooked a lot. The other tip is starting your RIF at age 65. Now, we're going through, again, it's tax season, so we're seeing some new clients, and also often, I find people, if they don't need the money, they say, well, why should I start my RIF? And a lot of these people are self-employed. I find self-employed people like to keep working. They enjoy their job. They're 70 years old. They haven't even collected. They've got lots of money in RSPs, but they haven't started an income from their RIF, mainly because they don't need to. Now, the reason I would recommend this is because these self-employed people normally, they don't have a pension. They don't have a government pension or any kind of defined benefit plan. And at 65, you qualify for the $2,000 pension credit. Now, that works out to $735 a year in savings each year. Not a big deal after I just finished talking about $85,000. But still, I'd rather get the $735,000 in our clients' pockets. Now, on top of that, that's per spouse. So if you and your spouse both have lots of RSPs and you're still working, or you haven't, you didn't need the money, you're just simply taking it on and you say, I don't need this income. Why pay tax early? I would set up a RIF. It has to be moved. Your RSP has to be moved to a RIF. You don't have to move the whole thing. Just move, I don't know, $40,000 over to your RIF and start taking out $2,000 a year. And you'll do this for the next 7 years, because you can defer your RSP until you're 71, in which case you have to move it to a RIF. And then the following year, you must take an income from it, in which case you're 72. Well, by following this little tip, you end up both getting an extra $435 per year. Over 7 years, it works out to about $6,100 extra over those 7 years. Again, it's probably not life-changing, but if, as far as I'm concerned, I'd rather have that $6,100 in your pocket. So that's the second tip. And the other RIF tip, if you will, that kind of just flows off the tongue, doesn't it? The other RIF tip is, and this happens often, is where a spouse is earning a lot lower income. And let's say, you know, he or she's at 60 years of age. And they've done a great job in income splitting. Their family has got $500,000 in one spouse's name and $500,000 in the other, in their own RSP. So one's in a spousal RSP, one's in their own RSP. And because one was the main breadwinner, okay? So they got $1 million saved up for retirement. Well, I have to always remind clients that RSPs, it's really, take the retirement out of it. This is deferred tax planning. You will, it's a deferred investment plan, if you will, and you do have to pay tax on it. So if there's any chance to get the money out of the RSPs at a low tax rate, go for it. And so one option is simply to have your spouse pull money out of their RIF. So you take the $500,000, move it into the spousal RSP rather, move it into a spousal RIF and start drawing out the minimum. Now, the reason is there's this 3-year attribution rule. So if you put money into your spouse's RSP, spousal RSP, and pull it out the next year, it's attributed right back to you. Because let's say you put in $10,000 for the last 3 years, and then you pull out $30,000 out of the spousal RSP thinking, it's going to be added to the lower income spouse. No, the government's got these rules called attribution rules where it has to be attributed back to you. The exception to this is if you move it into a spousal RIF and take out the minimum. So the minimum, you move the $500,000 over, start drawing out this minimum. Now the minimum is zero the first year, and it is whatever the minimum is the second year. So if you're 60 years old, the minimum would be about $17,000. Well, this lower income spouse, if that's her only income, she's paying no tax on this. It's tax free. They would lose a spousal deduction. So that works out to about an 18% tax rate. I don't know about you, but I would pull out all my RSPs if I could pay 18% tax. It is a deal. So if you can do this, it is a deal. Now, after the third year, assuming they haven't continued contributing to the spousal RSP, because you can, if you like, even though she's receiving or he's receiving, the lower income spouse receiving this income from the RIF, they can still add to the spousal RSP. But let's say they stop doing that. After the third year, they can then pull out $51,000 out of that spousal RSP and pay about $7,500 in income tax on this. That's only 14% tax. Then after that, the other spouse retires, and then there's income splitting. The whole point is you need to have a conversation with your financial planner to look at what's the best way to manage these RSPs. They're a bit of a tax bomb. And if we can kind of minimize that tax bomb and pay 14% or 18% tax on it, We'll do it in a second.
We are planning your financial future. I'm Scott Thompson. Don Fox and Mitch Fox are here from Fox Group Private Wealth Management. You can find out more at donfox.net. You can call them at IG Private Wealth Management at 905-972-7420. We're going to take a quick break here. We're coming back.
You are listening to a paid commercial program. Unless otherwise identified, the guests on the program are employees of or otherwise represent the advertiser. The opinions expressed therein are those of the advertiser and do not necessarily reflect the views and policies of 900CHML.
We are planning your financial future. I'm Scott Thompson. Don Fox and Mitch Fox are here from Fox Group Private Wealth Management. You can find out more at donfox.net. You can call them at IG Private Wealth Management at 905-972-7420. Tax refund, to get one or not. What's the best option here?
Yeah, it's that time of year again, Scott, isn't it? It's tax time and lots of people are hoping for refunds and not the unexpected surprise of having to pay. That's always the hope, isn't it?
Yeah.
But everyone's filing their taxes now. And while it's great to get a refund, there is a strategy that I just did read about and I thought it was pretty interesting. And it may sound counterintuitive, but getting a big refund may not be that great in the end. So we're going to take a look at why it's better not to get a tax refund, instead receive the extra money in your paycheck throughout the year. First of all, though, why do you get a tax refund? A lot of people don't understand that tax, if you're paying tax throughout the year, and if you do get a refund, it means you paid too much tax. It's really not a gift from the government. It's just you're paying tax at the source, and the amount that you get on your paycheck, they all had tax deductions taken from it, as well as CPP and EI, by your company's payroll department. And the tax withheld is an estimate of your tax liability to the government, and it's sent to the CRA on your behalf. So why would you get a tax refund? So the why you'd get a tax refund is that your payroll department doesn't take into account several common payments that you make throughout the year that can be claimed on your tax return to reduce your tax owing. And this may include personal non-related RSP contributions, childcare expenses, spousal support, charitable donations, or other sorts of donation tax deductions like interest on an investment loan, for example. So why is it better not to get a tax refund? So getting a large tax refund can be considered inefficient tax planning. Every month, you pay more tax than you need to, and that money sits in the CRA's office, and it's not earning any interest for you. It might be making interest for the government instead of contributing to your own financial plan. So for some of that money, it could take as long as 16 months before you get it back, depending on when you actually end up filing your taxes. So let's say on May 1st, you receive a tax refund of $5,040 for your previous year's tax contributions. And this is certainly a nice windfall and enough money to make a significant contribution to some of your savings goals. But what would happen if you receive $420 in cash every month instead of a big tax refund lump sum at the end? So let's say you invested this additional money and earned a return of 5%, which is a pretty modest return. You can even get GICs right now that pay that. By the following May 1st, your capital invested for the previous year would still be $5,040. However, that amount would have grown to $5,243, which is an extra $203. Not that much for 1 year, but if you do that over 10, 20, or even 30 years that you're working there, like I said earlier in the show, the compound return really kicks in and grows that substantially. So getting that money working for you sooner rather than later makes quite a difference. And if you extrapolate that 203 over 30 years at 5%, you're looking at a difference of having $349,000 versus $334,000 investing the same amount on an annual basis. So that's a difference of roughly $15,000. And you're still investing the exact same amount, but you're just having it work longer for you. So how can you reduce your paycheck deductions? So you can reduce your payroll deductions possibly right at the source through HR. It's possible to do that. Or you may have to fill out a Government of Canada T1213 request to reduce tax deductions at the source and send the completed form to your nearest CRA tax center. The government will then see if you qualify. And if you do, then you'll be able to send that to your HR and you'll get it done. Now, I do want to mention that this is someone who's disciplined.
Yes.
just it is a strategy, but also if you do this, you have to make sure that you are putting it into your RSP or your TFSA and then doing proper tax planning with a financial planner before the RSP deadline the following year. So it strictly does have to be meant to be putting away and earning that 5%. Everything that I just said a few minutes ago goes out the door if you're taking this and going on trips, going out to restaurants, going to bars, whatever, going to the Masters.
That will take more than that $300.
Yeah, maybe at the end of that $15,000, that'll get you there. But the double tip of putting that money into your RSP for the previous tax year and getting a tax refund, investing in your accounts is a very beneficial strategy. But like I mentioned, you do have to stay disciplined and make sure that you are doing this. Essentially, moving from being borrowed from the government, once you start taking funds from your RIF that has to be paid back, we hope that less tax when you put it away than when you are. So Don was obviously, he's talking about avoiding the high tax. So when you're working, you're earning a high tax. And when you're not working, hopefully you're in that 18 to 30% tax and you're not having to pay so much when you're taking it out. So that's the whole point of winning on getting a tax refund. So when you do get a refund, a lot of people, really not our clients, because we have this discussion with them a lot, is that it's not a gift. It's just because you've paid too much tax. And you should be putting it away into accounts and double dipping on the compound interest, not taking it and doing fun stuff with it.
And you're right. Most people look at that as a total windfall. And the thoughts of them actually doing something disciplined it goes totally against human nature. So they will probably do something that will not compound and grow. It'll do something that is just fun and maybe it'll be gone that night after they received it.
how many people do you see go on a trip and say, I got a tax refund this year, let's go?
Yeah.
Another place to put your returns there. So if you do get a refund, could be your mortgage or a line of credits, because the interest rates, as we said many times, have risen substantially. And paying those down as well is another good place so that you're saving on those payments as well. So going through this with your financial planner, make sure that you're not putting it into trips and fun stuff. Put it away and save yourself long term.
We are planning your financial future. I'm Scott Thompson. Don Fox and Mitch Fox are here from Fox Group Private Wealth Management. You can find out more at donfox.net. You can call them at IG Private Wealth Management at 905-972-7420. A quick break here. We're coming back.
You are listening to a paid commercial program. Unless otherwise identified, the guests on the program are employees of or otherwise represent the advertiser. The opinions expressed therein are those of the advertiser and do not necessarily reflect the views and policies of 900CHML.
We are planning your financial future. I'm Scott Thompson. Don Fox and Mitch Fox are here from Fox Group Private Wealth Management. You can find out more at donfox.net. You can call them at IG Private Wealth Management at 905-972-7420. Investor behavior. That's where every plan changes, isn't it?
Oh, it's all good. And I know Mitch is talking about discipline. And I know, you know, for those listeners, Mitch sounds like a bit of a buzzkill. You know,
I'm not going to be popular. I'm not going to be popular for that one.
Yeah, put that money in discipline. And you know what? But you know what also is a bit of a buzzkill is not having enough money at retirement. And that is the biggest fear most people have. And unfortunately, without proper planning, that fear could realize. So, you know, it's kind of interesting. Since 1994, Dalbar has done this study on investors' behavior. And I know I talked about this a couple weeks ago. I finally got the 2023's version. And by the way, anybody that would like to email us at don.fox.net, feel free, and we'll send you a PDF of this. It's very interesting stuff. And it just shows what the difference between what the performance is of the funds. And now this is a US study, but it really doesn't matter too much. And it shows that the prudence, the message really here is the prudence of a long-term buy and hold strategy and how that will improve. And what we find is there's a vast difference between what the investor is actually getting versus what the mutual fund is getting, or managed money, or whatever you want to call it. This is commonplace. And the reason is because investors' behavior gets in the way. The folly of measuring investment success against statistical benchmarks. Now, they'll look at different funds and say, look at this fund. Well, that's great, But who actually got that performance? The only ones that got that performance that were in that fund for that period of time. And what's the chance that you were in that for that last 10 years? Well, interesting enough, not a great chance, because the average investor is in the fund for less than 5 years. So how are you going to get a 10-year return if you're in the fund for less than 5 years? So the awareness of common behavior influence and the lessons from past markets. So all these things have a big impact. So a perfect example, last year, the S&P 500 had a return of 26.29%. Outstanding. What do you think the average client got investing in U.S. equities last year? Any guesses?
15.
Well, you're giving them, you're not giving them quite enough credit. 20.79%. So not bad. But the whole point is,
I was going to say that
they lost out on over 5% of the return because they pulled money out. And so their average is that there was still negative cash flow going into equity funds. This is, by the way, for the eighth consecutive year, for the eighth year in a row. And I know Mitch mentioned on a show earlier, it was a hated bull market the last 8 years. Of course, 22 was a negative year. Well, of course, it's hated when you're actually taking more money out than adding in to different funds. So, yeah, it hurts the returns. The average return, it turned out to be a behavior gap, is what they call, between what you would have got if you stayed in the fund versus what you really got, was 5.5%. It cost you 5.5% because you thought you could time the market. So, and this, by the way, this is the third largest gap in the last 10 years. So it was a fairly large gap. A lot of people just were getting impatient. Now, it doesn't make a lot of sense. So the average equity fund investor, again, US, withdrew $2,965 last year, but they gained $20,172. So they ended up at the end of the year with $117,000. And there, you know what? For most people, they would have thought, hey, look at me. I got $117,000. Problem is, had they just stuck the $100,000 in and left it there, it would have been worth $126,000, a difference of over $9,000 just in 1 year. That's on a $100,000 investment. Now, if they actually needed to pull out that $2,965, they would have had, still, it would have cost them a little over $6,000, the average investor. Now, that's average. Men generally do worse. Okay, so whatever the average is, men do worse, women generally do better. Married men do a little bit better than single men. And married women are the best investors because they keep the money in. They leave it there longer. So the retention rates have averaged 4.94% in 23, meaning 4.94 years. So the average investor is keeping the money invested in equity funds for 4.954 years. So just under 5 years. So again, this is going back to what I said. If you're looking at fund performance at 10 years and you're only in it for five, then it doesn't apply to you. So what are these psychological reasons? Number one is loss aversion. They're expecting to find higher returns with lower amount of risk. So when the markets are down, they just can't take this risk anymore. And they think, I got to get out. I got to go to GICs. I can find a better return there. And the market's going to continue to go down. They're extrapolating the downturn, which inevitably it goes right up after they sell. Usually by the time they're at their brink of what they can handle, they take their money out. And then the market goes up. And that happened in November, December of 23. Narrow framing. They make decisions based on one small area, say tax, for example, or there's a political crisis. There's so many moving parts when it comes to investing. It's hard for anybody to have a wider frame. Mental accounting. They're taking undue risks in one area and avoiding a rational risk in the other. So this is their own game that investors do. And anchoring is one where they think, okay, once it gets to this price, I'm selling. Or once it goes down, I'm getting out. And because they've anchored a dollar. Well, I paid $100,000 at $30 a share. Once it gets up to $30, I'm out. Well, what if it's Nortel and it just keeps going down? on the other hand, what if it's Apple and it keeps going up and you missed out on all that growth? So anchoring doesn't work. Regrets, there's media response, there's the herding attitude of people just like to do things together. It's like a party going on in marijuana stocks and we all want to go in on this. Oh, well, by the way, they're all down about 95%+ now. And there was a time when we had tons of calls about marijuana stocks. So it's a herding mentality. At the end of the day, diversification is extremely important. Getting rich slow. And that's what Mitch and I preach to all our clients, trying to find an investment within their comfort zone, train them to understand the markets will fluctuate and be in it for the long term, and you'll do extremely well.
We have been planning your financial future. I'm Scott Thompson. Don Fox and Mitch Fox have been here from Fox Group Private Wealth Management. You can find out more at donfox.net. You can call them at IG Private Wealth Management at 905-972-7420. Thank you, gentlemen. Another fabulous show.
The preceding was a paid commercial program. Unless otherwise identified, the guests on the program are employees of or otherwise represent the advertiser. The opinions expressed therein are those of the advertiser and do not necessarily reflect the views and policies of 900 CHML.